Hello, citizens of the Procrastination Nation. Welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, home of high-end pop culture conversation from low-end pop culture commentators. I'm Andrew Harrison, and I'm joined as usual by Sean Pattenden, the organic vegan wrapped to my mechanically recovered chlorine-washed chicken nuggets. Hello, Sean. How are you doing?
Ooh, I'm not sure which one of us is best, actually. You said that.
Organic vegan wrap, definitely. Better for you.
No fun, though.
Just to start bringing everybody down, by the way, there was a story on the BBC this week that streaming music is actually bad for the planet because it uses electric. Researchers at Keele University said streaming hi-fi costs three times as much energy to run a year as a CD player. So are you going to go green and only listen to new old records in physical form?
I'm just going to hum.
Going to hum?
Yeah, I'm just going to hum hits to myself.
I read a fantastic comment on a Guardian thing about streaming media, and the guy said, I don't know why people waste £10 on streaming music. I've got all the songs I could possibly wish to hear in my head and I can play them for free.
Oh, God.
Great idea.
We'll probably be talking about him later in the Freaky Dancing.
Think about it, yeah. The logical conclusion of the research was that you should only have one record and you should never play it.
Fair enough.
Yes, we have two guests with us this week. Linda Marek writes about film for Empire Magazine, The Jewish Chronicle and The London Economic. London Economic what? Who knows? London Economic everything. She's the editor of screenwords.co.uk and she sees a lot of films. Hello, Linda. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm very well,
thank
you.
How's everyone?
Oh, we're all very well. We've got you to talk about the Oscars later on, but first, I want to get your quick reactions to some film stuff that's coming up later in this year. Brad Pitt to do a Chris Cornell biopic. What do you think about that?
I think it's brilliant. I mean, we haven't really seen Brad Pitt do anything for a while, so looking forward to that.
He would give good beard, wouldn't he?
Good
tragedy. Yeah. The casting for Denis Villeneuve's version of Dune, he's got like literally everybody.
Yes.
We are the only people who aren't in this
film. I think my point was made, I said earlier this week, it's as if he said, who's hot right now, bring them to me. And I mean, it's fine. I mean, I'm quite happy with the cast list.
Because he's got Timothée
Chalamet.
Yes, who you can pronounce like
him.
Dave Bautista, who I can pronounce.
Oh, I love him.
It's got Aquaman, whose name I can never remember. It's got Stellan Skarsgård.
Yeah.
And it's definitely
Oscar Isaac as well, I think.
Oscar Isaac, yes. Yeah. Now, the original film adaptation, the David Lynch adaptation of Dune, continues to be a laughingstock for Sting and his plastic underpants. But it is one of the great stories that really deserves to be made into a proper sprawling space opera, isn't it? And
is now
the time.
I mean, I am a fan of the original. I know many people aren't, but I'm really looking forward to this. And it's Denis Villeneuve who I think will do it justice.
There you go. Well, definitely. The password is Jodorowsky's Dune. Sean, who else is here with us in the studio?
Well, you wait for months for someone from The Quietest to turn up, and like buses, two turn up at once. Last week, we had Luke Turner in talking about his excellent book, Out of the Woods. And this week, it's the co-founder and editor of the Strange Noises Music website, John Duran. Hello, John. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. You've been writing about punishing guitar music, baroque electronica and weirdo classical music on The Quietus for a decade now. You also present Noisy's regular video series, British Masters, where you interview people like Viv Albertine and Cozy Fanny Tutti. You also write Vice's endlessly entertaining column, Menk. And you're the author of Jolly Lad. This is your life, isn't it? One of the most bleakly entertaining memoirs of substance and mental health issues you could read. Welcome back.
It is a bit like This Is Your Life, isn't it? I'm just waiting for a succession of like really dour-looking cocaine dealers to walk through the door.
He's here with us tonight. and you owe him 50 quid.
Yeah.
We have it on good authority. You've recorded a terrifying 50-minute long cover version of Nilsson's Without You as guest vocalist for Andrew Lil of Nurse With Wound. Can you explain?
It was a bit of quid pro quo. Andrew was doing a little bit of recording for me for a spoken word project that I was doing. And he said, whilst you're here, he's got a very lovely house in Heptonstall in the Calder Valley. He goes, while you're here, I'm just recording a little album of covers for my 50th birthday. And he's doing the 50 number one songs that were at number one on each of his birthdays, but each version is 50 minutes long. Seriously, it's insane. Half the album, so the 25-hour long part one came out last year, and the second 25-hour part one is coming out in a couple of weeks on March the 11th. And he's got me doing the Nilsson song and Toxic by Britney Spears.
Oh, nice.
As a segue, the medley.
No, each of those songs are 50 minutes long each.
My goodness. For 50 minutes.
Are you breaking the sacred barrier between rock journo and subject there?
Yeah, I've like really kind of had a massive change of heart on this. I think that I never wanted to be a musician, Mike. I'm not one of these writers who always fancied himself being in a band or was a failed musician. Yeah. And I always used to think it was slightly lame, the people who'd kind of tried to launch secondary careers. I think music writing is a brilliantly intrinsic thing, and I hopefully will be doing it for the rest of my days. However, you know, you're probably aware that how small the pool of everything is getting, the amount of people who have kind of like fled to go and do more sensible
Real jobs.
Exactly, yeah. And I just feel like, especially at my end of things, it's like everyone now knows each other. Our world is very, very small. Mm. We all go to the same festivals. We go to the same gigs. I think it was only a matter of time before I got roped into doing something completely pretentious myself.
Well, the logical conclusion is you'll be roadieing as well. You'll be A&Ring for someone. You're probably pressing the records at some point.
Well, you know, I've done a bit of all of that, actually. Yeah.
Oh, OK. Andrew's been Twitter stalking you, apparently, according to him. He spotted the following events. Ortec have just put 19 albums out in the same week, and we notice you're threatening your children with the words, get ready for school or I will put Ortec on.
Now, this is like, very, you know, if you know Ortec, like you would imagine that this would kind of encourage a seven-year-old to put his shoes on much quicker. However, I tried it the following day with Pig Destroyer, the American grindcore band.
Of course.
And at first, he was horrified. But 3 days later, now he's into Pig Destroyer, which is not the result I was looking for.
Was it a case of, like, put your shoes on or I'm putting Ortec on? So you put Ortec on, and then he, like, dismantles the shoes and then, turns them inside out and wears part on a shoulder and part on a knee. There you go.
Exactly, yeah.
Very nice. Apparently, there was also a copy of the Fools 45, 84, 89 compilation in the pile of Lego.
Now, I've been really, really forthright about this in the past. I've said several times that I used to think that middle-aged dads who try and get their kids into Joy Division and The Fall should be reported to social services. It's only a step above child abuse. And then I had this DJ engagement coming up about a couple of years ago where I was playing nothing but The Fall all night in a nightclub. And it just so happened I had to listen to The Fall at home. And then the next day, I noticed my son walking through the house whistling shoulder pads to himself. And I was like, oh, what have I done?
You've done it now.
Yeah, I don't want him to grow up to be into The Fall. I want him to grow up and be happy. You know?
and the cycle of misery continues.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, there we go. Later on in the show, John will be talking us through a new compilation of the Manchester Acid House fanzine, Freaky Dancing, which The Quietus are putting out, and we will be rejoining the rave up. Linda will be walking us through some of the Oscar nominations that are worth your attention. And we'll all be delving into the new anthology, of Sean Ryder's lyrics, as predicted on this very podcast. Thank you very much. As well as talking about the Netflix programme everybody in the entire world is watching, Russian Doll, a.k.a. Groundhog Eve. Why does Natasha Lyonne keep dying? And will she ever get out of that party on the Lower East Side in the very trendy flat and find her cat Oatmeal? All that and more after a gentle reminder from Andrew.
If you enjoy Big Mouth, you don't have to wait till Saturday to get the podcast. Sign up and support us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon and we'll send you the show a day early. Plus the famous extra bit where, for the past few weeks and the next few weeks, we're asking our guests to confess the best and worst people they've interviewed. Back us and you can listen to Big Mouth on a Friday night and make the journey home a little more tolerable. All we're asking for is the equivalent of £5 a month to cover some of our studio bills. I think that's the price of an expensive pint, whereas Sean thinks it's the price of a pint of cooking lager, which tells you where Sean goes drinking. Either way, we'll appreciate it. Just search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out how you can help. All we are saying is, however expensive it is, buy us a pint. Okay, let's start with Russian Doll, the Netflix word-of-mouth hit that snuck out at the start of February and has become the show they're all talking about. Developed by and starring American Pie and Orange is the New Black's Natasha Lyonne, it depicts a full-on car crash personality, Nadia Volvakov, who goes to a birthday party on New York's Lower East Side, dies in an accident, and then keeps coming back to life. What's so compelling about this series? What is its secret? Let's have a taster.
Are you going to tell me what's going on?
I keep dying and reliving the same night.
Does it hurt?
Yes.
You seem fine.
I'm not fine. I'm questioning my own sanity.
We got to take the fire escape.
I have a fire escape? I have to change my Airbnb listing then.
What was wrong with the stairs?
It's a long story involving multiple deaths.
Yeah, this is much safer.
I never lasted this long.
Those things are a menace!
OK, you cockroaches, Russian Doll with Natasha Lyonne. John Doran, apparently you've watched this twice.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely fabulous. It's the first time I've binge-watched an entire series in one sitting in a long time. And really, like, I hope I'm not projecting too much stuff onto it, but it ticks, like, three of my really major boxes, which is determinism, addiction, and existential crisis. And at first I was like, you know, maybe I am projecting stuff onto this, but I've since read a few interviews with Natasha Lyonne, and apparently I'm not. You know, like, one of the big inspirations for the series was the three writers, the also wonderful Amy Poehler of Parks and Rec, and the playwright, whose name I've forgotten, Leslie Headland. They were all reading Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which was like a very famous sort of work of existential writing done by a survivor a few months after the liberation of Auschwitz. Now, and then also I found out that I might have nothing whatsoever in common with Natasha Lyonne, apart from one thing, that we're both recovering addicts who cleaned up on after their 36th birthday. I think this is really, really core to what the series is about. It's a very, very blunt, on one level, metaphor for addiction, you know, every day essentially being the same. But then I like the way that you're seeing a side of addiction which you don't usually see on the small screen, which is like a relatively less messy, high-functioning addiction from a person who's like a professional. And then what you actually see is that experience might be purgatorial, but also it's a functional and grimly funny purgatory.
Well, grimly funny is a thing of it. Yeah, it's an incredibly funny show. And, you know, my one or two addicts I've known have said the dark secret of the addictive lifestyle is that you can't get away from is it's fun. It might destroy everything around you, but while it's happening, it's fun. And that's the extremely
I would really, really want to inject at that point and say that's obviously not the same for all addicts.
Certainly,
that was a big factor in my experience of 25 years of kind of heavy drinking and drug use. For sure. And like, you know, but everything about this is so perfectly judged. That the choice of the Harry Nilsson song, you know, everything about it is just brilliant.
It's a big Nilsson week for you, isn't it? A very big Nilsson week.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but like the way that, you know, I saw somebody online describe it as being like an onion, and I would agree with that completely. So it's like, you know, this peeling away of layers, where you're getting towards this nub of like traumatic childhood like incident, which is obviously at the root of a lot of kind of people with addiction problems.
Linda, did you enjoy it?
I absolutely loved it. I watched the first episode and then found myself just, you know, forward and just watching every single one. I think they're really short. It's about eight of them, and they're really short.
They're about 22 minutes, aren't they?
And you just watch them. I felt really guilty because I had other things to do. I had other writing to do. But I loved it. What I loved about it is that, you know, we're constantly being told that people are consuming rubbish, things that don't matter, but this is a series about a metaphysical crisis, about someone who is having troubles, you know, relating to their death. And that's why I loved what it reminded me of like films like, you know, series of the early 2000s like Dead Like Me. And what I also loved about it is she's openly smoking, she's openly drinking, and there is no judgment. And I also liked her as a character, and I liked her as an actress.
She's the most likable, dislikable character around, isn't she? She's utterly charming, and actually that's her fatal flaw. Her charm is what's enabling her to continue in this appalling path.
And I saw a lot of myself in her, you know, at her age, obviously. So absolutely loved it.
In a lot of respects as well, it's a retelling of the classic New York story, that New York is the amazing mystical place where rules don't apply, and you can maintain you can remain forever young, and you can be as weird as you like. It's like
a bit like London, really, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, you only realise that you're getting older when you move out of London, like I have done very recently. And you realise that you've been in this kind of melting pot, and then you take yourself out of it. You're not the same person anymore. And what I also liked about it, I think what I'm liking about both Netflix and Amazon, they're releasing these like, some people have compared it a bit to The Good Place, and I think it's kind of a bit like The Good Place, but The Good Place is not as serious or as sort of edgy. But have you, I don't know if any of you have watched Forever on Amazon, the Maya Rudolph of Fred Armisen. It's brilliant, and I mean, there are lots of comparisons between that and this, and they're also half an hour episodes as well.
I think the Netflix format works brilliantly because you get eight fake cliffhangers that only last for a few seconds because you can play the next one. Yeah. And also, Netflix is an addiction as well. Sean, what was your take on it?
Well, I hated it at first.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Aren't you supposed to, though?
Maybe you are, because I thought this is dealing with types. And I'm used to Netflix just selling me types. New York, damaged. Obviously, she's got to go through something. Smoking, drinking, taking lots of drugs. Yeah, I've seen that. Can you give me something more around it? And then, oh, OK, yeah, I see. And then grew to really, really warm to it and then really love it. I think I'm on episode 6. But I'm actually stopping myself from watching them all in one go just to pull back and then think about it and then go back again like some SWAT. Mm. Some of the lines are amazing. So obviously the story, it's quite traditional as a story. It's a Grimm's fairy tale. And they reference Emily of New Moon, which is... partly what it's taken from. Apparently there are Easter eggs about. It's all about Easter eggs and gaming as well. But there are some lines, and she says it so quickly. She says at one point, sexualising self-hatred is the hallmark of any relationship that begins with an extramarital infidelity. And you go, what? I rewound it to listen to this ping, ping, ping. You know, it's really sharp-witted. She is incredible. Annoying at first and then incredible. But as I say, it's a morality tale. I mean, you want the good to succeed and you want evil to disappear. You want her to reconcile with her past. Quite like the fact that it's really traditional, like a bedtime story or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I loved it. I particularly love the just dripping through of insane little details about characters that tell you so much, like the initial one where her friend who runs the party finds an harmonica on the table and goes, oh, there you are, toot! You know, for no reason at all. It just tells you volumes about that character. I love the idea of New York as a time loop where things never change.
Also, the house that she, no spoiler, but the house that she keeps being reborn in looks like a church. All these signifiers and all these symbols within it that you can, and I would go back and watch it again. I think this definitely is a second viewing kind of programme.
My only issue with it is I can believe that somebody would come back from the dead over and over again. I cannot believe anybody would have an apartment that big in New York.
Oh, well, it's Friends stuff.
It is Friends, isn't it?
The trope.
TARDIS apartments. So we love this, don't we? We think it's fantastic.
I think it's amazing, yeah. I think it's a bit of a find.
Absolutely.
Okay, moving away from the eternal cycle of life and death, it's time for some music chosen by one of our guests. John Duran, what is your editor's recommendation today?
Sveg by Errant Monks. And this just landed on my desk as Andrew was emailing, so it's quite happenstance. I love this group. They're like a cross between a bunch of angry Marquis Smiths fronting the kind of Rope for Luck era Happy Mondays on a lot more crack cocaine, I would say.
Oh dear.
And Sveg is a Russian term, which means when a fault plane gives way and jerks, suddenly creating a earthquake. And Joseph Charms, the frontman of this group, is also, coincidentally, I guess, a recovering alcoholic. And this refers to, he had a very severe epileptic fit when withdrawing and cracked his head and had to go and have his head x-rayed. And it's about that, I believe.
Cheerful stuff.
Fantastic.
Not at all, really. But it's quite up-tempo, actually.
OK, great. Errant Monks and Sveg. Never let it be said, this podcast does not have power and influence. Only a few weeks ago, we were talking about Bummed by Happy Mondays and wondering why nobody had done a book of Sean Ryder's lyrics yet. It was a treasured dream of Tony Wilson, who said that Ryder was in the tradition of Yeats. And then, presto, what arrives in the area, as they said back in the good old days, but Wrote for Luck, gift of a title, really, Sean Ryder's selected lyrics. It's the latest in Faber's series of great lyrics by great lyricists. don't know why they're so pleased with themselves. We were doing this on Smashes years ago. Meanwhile, in a remarkable coincidence, John's company, The Quietus, are publishing an anthology of freaky dancing, the infamous Hacienda fanzine full of cartoons and reportage on the glory days of rave. We're going to be talking about both of them after some suitable music. From Happy Mondays, it's God's Cop, from Pills and Thrills and Bellyaches. And then, so we can all pretend we're in the Hacienda still, it's ancient British house tune Carino by T. Coy. Then I feel for the young bad for the MX goal. Because the love she comes and all knows them all. Oh, and everybody said I chose the soul. God made it easy. God made it easy on me. God made it easy on me. God made it easy. God made it easy on me. God made it easy on me. John Doran, should we collect musicians' lyrics in book form?
Depends who the musician is, doesn't it? Like, I've got a lot of time for Faber Social. I'm not going to make any bones about that. Like, I like them as people. I like what they do. I'm not going to keep every single one of these books, even if I get sent them for free. I am, however, you know, I've got a special place on my bookcase, not just for this, but for the Scott Walker anthology, which I believe, like, Sundog was the first one that they did. Now, there's another issue that runs parallel to this, which is, like, does rock music even need to make an appeal to the high-minded kind of academy to have their lyrics treated as seriously as poetry when it's something different and it does a different thing? But, yeah, intrinsically, it depends who the musician is. And with Sean Ryder, I think my jury's saying, yeah, it's fair enough, yeah.
What did you make of the collected works? All of them in one book.
Right, so I like the notes, yeah. I like the intro. I was waiting immediately. As soon as I heard about this, the first thing I thought was, Tony Wilson's ridiculous W.B. Yeats statement. And I remember thinking it was ridiculous at the time, but I've actually had a bit of a change of heart about that. And that is, like, I guess there's that thing of, like, you know, Tony Wilson may have come from Salford, but there's this, like, kind of apprehension about him, I think. He was actually very middle class and very well educated. He was an honours student from Cambridge. And Tony Wilson was smart enough never to turn round and say, Alan Hempsall from Crispy Ambulance is our generation's T.S. Eliot. You know, he never said the dude Mark Reeder from Shark Vegas was like our Seamus Heaney, did he? He was smart enough to know that he could only say that about Sean Ryder, because there is something brilliant about Sean's lyrics. And for me, it's like, for every duff or lyric that great slightly or something that's a bit casually sexist or whatever, then you'll stumble across something like, how old are you? Are you old enough? Should you be in here looking at that?
Yes.
And you're like, that is just one of the greatest, like, opening salvos in a rock record ever written. And for my money, if I can count them right, good, 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 double, double, good. Brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
It's clear from the introduction lyrics were always a stream of consciousness. Manchester unfolding like a cartoon. Is that evocative for you?
Yes, kind of. Although, you know, I lived in Hull during the kind of, like, the acid house boom, and I had my own kind of rave elation, as Simon Reynolds would call it, I guess, like a few years after. Yeah. I moved to Manchester and started enjoying that lifestyle in about 1994. I got there and I used to go to the Hacienda, but only just as it was closing.
Right.
And so I missed the real... I got there just for the darkness, to be brutally honest. I missed all of the kind of the euphoric stuff at the end of the 80s. So, yes, because Sean Ryder's lyrics, and this is something I would probably disagree with some people about his lyrics, is I find them always baleful. I found them world-weary from the start.
Right.
And they're shot through with little glints of optimism, but I I find it quite a bittersweet experience because I think it's like an optimistic view of the future that maybe Sean Ryder didn't experience on some levels.
Mm. Yeah, the lyrics to Tart Tart aren't particularly gleeful, are they?
No, no.
Linda, what did you think of
it? I really loved it. I read this like in one sitting. I just absolutely loved it. What I liked about it, he talks throughout about the euphoric years and then the darker years, but I found that lots of it is really dark, like John was saying. But also it's dark, but even I think the state they were in then, they didn't realise how dark it was. I mean, all the stuff about living in this, the gaff that had no door, a broken door and people coming in. What I loved is the way he talks about his lyrics is not intellectualised in any way. It's not corrected in any way. And I just frank. And also the regrets he has about certain lyrics as well. I mean, he's like slagging off vegetarians afterwards. He says, oh, well, I shouldn't have done that because that's not very right. And that endeared him to me more than anything else. I just think I respect someone who can put their hands up and say, yeah, I wasn't that nice then. And I've just loved it. I really loved the way he sort of, he was retrospective. He looked so much into the stuff that he achieved and the stuff that he was about to achieve. Mm-hmm. I liked
so
it a
the
lot.
Notes actually were more enlightening than just
I don't really remember many of their lyrics apart from like Step On or, so it was interesting for me to sort of read the lyrics and then I picked out he picked out the stuff that really mattered to him because he. What did you think?
I really loved this, but then I'm sort of on board for it anyway because I love the Happy Mondays and in a way this is sort of an end. This is the end of the Happy Mondays for me because it's finally the key to so many of those songs I thought were utterly impenetrable. Moving in with which John just mentioned is literally about that crash pad and beginning with we've got two bent pigs in the crash downstairs below and it's like literally cops that they're
they were real cops.
But what I love in that particular lyric is the famous Henny Penny Cocky Locky Goosey Lucy Turkey Lurkey Ducky Lucky Chicken Licking. Turns out they were all individual nicknames for individual members of the Happy Mondays as well. As well as X and Cow Pig and Knobhead and all these. Because everybody needed multiple identities because anybody was always being, it was always out on the rob. But this particular lyric I really love because it shows you how clever he could be in kind of uniting the fantastical and the realistic. You know, the line goes from, it seems we're all on the move when the sound's falling in. It seems we're all on the move when the sky's coming in. It seems we're all on the move when the door's coming in. So it's everything from a psychedelic revelation to a police raid, all within the same thing, in a little twist of language.
I mean, it's really enlightening about Tamazepan.
Yeah.
And if you start reading about that, you should think, oh, my God.
It's from Tramazzi Party
really?
On the Black Grape album. Because Black Grape lyrics are here as well, aren't they?
Yes, and I that was the thing I read.
About him having a gun.
Last, Yeah. But Black Grape, well, the lyrics are all right. But, some of the explanations.
I also really liked his references to Performance, which is like a really obscure movie from the 60s or 70s, 60s, I think.
Late
60s. And actually, he references it twice or three times.
I think he talks about he had a worn-out videotape because there was no other way of watching it.
Nobody else had like anything else then, so,
There's a bit where he talks about Rope for Luck, which I think the lyrics are just up there. And there's part of the lyric, I don't read, I just guess. There's more than one sign, but it's getting less. He couldn't read when he left school. He didn't know his alphabet. And to read, I think, sometimes the explanation can take away from the lyrics, but I think that this really adds to it.
But also, you kind of see how much of an autodidact he is, because in Rope for Luck, you're wet, but you're getting dry, it comes from Stardust.
Yes.
Twisting My Melon on Step On, it's from the Steve McQueen documentary. Yeah. And that line about, you used to speak the truth, but now you're clever, it's about Sean and Bez playing up the caricature of the hard kids when they're being interviewed by the NME. And he talks about how they never hid anything, consequently there were no skeletons in the closet to be exposed, because his closet was always wide open. And there's all these little kind of little revelations across there that make you understand the whole setup.
And there's also like a mention of the God's cop, the chief of Manchester Police, who said that God was talking to him, speaking to him, and nobody... Everyone thought it was a perfectly normal thing then.
Yeah. Well, this guy is like a folk devil for a lot of Manchester musicians. Mm. I mean, like Hit the North by The Fall is about James Anderton.
Yeah.
James Anderton turns up as a character in Freaky Dancing as well, But
But isn't James Anderson also in those David Peace books kind of alluded to?
Yes, yeah.
He is a bit of a kind of a monster of the late 20th
century. Pop star of The Police.
Yeah.
I think the funniest bit, I literally chuckled when I read this, was when they were in Rio de Janeiro and they'd invited a few girls with them, and then Paul had left with this girl and he ended up robbing her instead of him, her robbing him. He said, well, she was going to rob me anyway, so I didn't.
I only got my stuff back. Yeah. Oh, her stuff, yeah. It's like, it is immensely seedy in a way that it's probably best experienced through the medium of lyrics rather than living it. John, tell us about the Freaky Dancing collection, the fanzine.
So, as I mentioned briefly before, I moved to Manchester just in time for like Manchester's legendary rave scene to collapse into really bad drugs and violence, and some of that I sampled myself. I went to see the Chemical Brothers play their first ever gig at the Hacienda. That was brilliant, you know. But yeah, I got taken under the wing of a group of really interesting people, like comic book writers, computer game designers, weekend caners, essentially. And they were the people who were, by and large, responsible for Freaky Dancing, this fanzine. And they would tell me about it, but it kind of wrapped up by this point. And I managed to pick up a few copies. And then we'd be going out all over the country, really, going out raving or whatever. And I always had like a real kind of like affection in my heart for this fanzine. And like, I've become really good friends with some of these people over the years. Paul, one of the editors especially, is a very good friend of mine. And he just mentioned one day, it was a few years ago now, he was like, you know, we'd love to do something, you know, just like none of us who, it's all a bunch of friends who are all in the late teens. Or early 20s at the highest, who had started going to the Hacienda in about 87, 88. And I think they were that kind of typical thing of like, they were school kids who'd grown up listening to kind of Joy Division and the Smiths, went to the Hacienda, sampled a little bit of what was going on there in 1988 and had their lives completely kind of changed or whatever, and had to produce this fanzine just to express this kind of radical shift that they were going through. I mean, they're all working class, you know what I mean? And it's like, I'm sure you can remember just how narrow horizons could be in the 80s, you know? So, yeah, we talked about it a few years ago and they just told me that they would love to do something with it. And I was like, straight away, there's no question about it. I'll publish it. You know, it's not a problem, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I felt it had a lot in common with The End, the great Liverpool fanzine of the 80s, which was a similar scenario. Basically, kind of talented layabouts who needed something to do with all the stuff in their heads. You know, you're probably not suitable for normal employment, but very funny and knew what was going on. And we used to pass copies of The End round at our school because we were a little bit younger than the people doing it. And it just, that actually, I think, fed into Loaded magazine as well, the idea that there's a shared sense of humour out there that isn't necessarily part of newspapers and magazines. The comic heart in it, because in the intro it's mentioned that like all we did was sit around reading Marvel comics and listening to the Smiths. I thought, you are my people. You know, I am you. Well, the artwork is like, it's some of it's a bit naive, some of it's really good. The recurrent theme of the time we first took E appears in a lot of these strips.
It's done over a very, very short period of time. I mean, apart from the odd thing here or there, it's done and dusted in a short space of time than punk was. I think it's like 89 and 90 and 91, and then it's all completely over. And I think they were very, very young. And I think like some of them are still in that world now. So like Steve Pickford, who's another of the editors, he's actually a really accomplished comic book artist now. Yeah. And I think, you know, he's about 50 maybe, or maybe he's about my age, so like late 40s. And he's, you know, got family and kids and stuff like that. And I think his cheeks flushed with crimson when he talks about this now, because he's like, I can't believe how drug focused it is. But we were that age, you know, and it seemed really important.
He does a great strip called 24-hour party pupils, huge eyeballs hanging out the bridge, and the kind of the mixture of like naive cartoonery, and you can see people are actually talented and they're building their talent before your eyes and actually getting quite good at it. Yeah. I thought it was really effective and really exciting. Sean, what did you think?
I liked it, but I felt that it was kind of people who had done a lot more than me by that age. I felt slightly alienated by the, hey, we'll take more drugs. Are there any ladies in it at all? Is it just blokes who look like they're in the Charlatans almost going to the Hacienda and waiting
Center
in a queue?
That's probably the scene.
There were quite a lot of...
You're a young lad, you hang around with lads, certainly, because girls are frightened.
There are a couple of women in it. Julie's in it, isn't she? I mean, like, but yeah, you are right. I mean, you are talking about, like, autodidact, young working-class lads who were coming out of a kind of, like I guess a gang mentality.
But they had sisters and they had girlfriends, and we were in one side of the room, obviously, and they were in the other. It seemed like that. But, I mean, absolutely, of its time, amazing. And as a document to have that, I mean, you know, fanzine culture is really important, man, for that sort of thing. And to have that, you know, and to have it out now.
It's another reason we should get rid of the internet. Ban the internet. Bring the fanzines back. Linda, you're a raver, did you? Did you see yourself in these pages?
I am a raver. I started more sort of early 90s rather, like, so the whole Hacienda thing completely passed me by because I was too young, but I recognise a lot of it, a lot of myself in the fanzine, without incriminating myself any further. But I just even though I know the lack of female presence obviously is an issue, but I think they're being just honest. I mean, that's who they hang out with,
no,
and
I don't
that's
sound
where you're
representing.
I don't mean that. But I mean, I knew loads of girls who did rave and who were interested in the music, didn't go out just for the drugs or for the dancing. Were really as interested in music as these the majority of boys. I really liked it. I think it's represented, as you say, there's a lot of naivety in it as well.
I think one thing, it's gift to the culture, is we finally got the correct term for that face that that Ian Brown kept pulling, and in fact all of the bowl-head characters kept pulling throughout that period. It's toilet roll mouth. That kind of monkey face.
There's also the running on spot.
Running on the spot, as Red Finstein wrote for Lucky, keep running on the racetrack, running around that rage track on that sort of, you know, 24-hour parts of people, isn't it? John, where can people get this?
Look at my website for the news story. That'll be thequietest.com. Just whack it into Amazon. It's called Freaky Dancing, the complete collection, I believe.
There you go.
Excellent. It's time for another tune from our guests. Linda Marrick, I believe you are staying in the Manchester area.
I am,
for your choice.
It's a bit of a weird choice for me as an ex-Morrissey fan. I'm kind of slowly getting back to listening to the music now because I'm able to sort of separate the man from his views and politics. But I chose We'll Let You Know because it has always been one of my favourite songs, solo songs from Morrissey. But I recently was watching the new Jonah Hill film, his directorial debut, which is called Mid-90s. And this came on suddenly, a really poignant scene. Mm. And I suddenly found myself in this screening room just bawling, crying my eyes out. But, I mean, that means nothing to anyone else, but it means a lot to me because I was really into Morrissey in those times, and I think it's just such, still a really poignant, beautiful song.
Is it because you miss Morrissey when you could like him?
I think I miss my memories of being a Morrissey fan. I miss the memories of sort of looking forward to standing outside, queuing up to get in, and being right at the front at the Morrissey gig, and sort of, you know, years of this I've done, and I haven't seen Morrissey in concert for a good 10 years now, and I think I don't miss him. I miss the friendships I made of being a Morrissey fan and the memories I made as well. So
here we go. It's Morrissey back when everyone liked him. From Your Arsenal, this is We'll Let You Know.
We'll let you know, but only if you're really interested. We're all smiles, then honest, I swear it's the turnstiles that make us hostile. Oh, 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 oh. We will descend on anyone unable to defend them. And the songs we sing, they're not supposed to mean a thing. La la la, la la la, la la la.
Finally, yes, it's the Oscars again, and somewhere behind the frocks and the arguments, there's some actual films. Linda's here to talk about some of the nominations for Best Picture and Actor, and we're going to chip in on some of the ones we've seen. As a taster, here's a bit of three of the front runners. The Favourite, nominated for Best Picture, with Best Actress nominee Olivia Colman and Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz both up for Best Support. Queen biopic Bohemian Rhapsody, also up for Best Picture, with Rami Malek as Best Actor for his Lord Frederick of Lucan. And Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant both up for their roles in Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Dearest Queen, you are mad, giving me a palace. It is a monstrous extravagance, Mrs. Morley. We are at war.
We won!
Oh, it is not over. We must continue.
Oh. Oh, I did not know that.
The Queen is an extraordinary person.
They were all staring, weren't they? I can tell even if I can't see, and I heard the word fat. Fat. And ugly.
No one but me would dare, and I did not.
It is important to make new friends in court, is it not?
You're so beautiful.
Stop it, you mock me.
If I were a man, I would ravish you. You have become close to Abigail.
She is a viper. You're jealous.
You must send Abigail away.
I do not want to.
Let's shoot something. Sometimes it is hard to remember whether you have loaded the pellet or not.
I enjoyed the show. I also write songs.
Our lead singer just quit. Then you'll need someone new.
I love the way you move on stage. The whole room belongs to you. Don't you see what you could be?
No one will play us on the radio.
We need to get experimental.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Do it again. One more.
How many more Galileos do you want?
Roger, there's only room in this band for one hysterical queen.
Nobody is going to pay for the writer Lee Israel right now.
I'm months behind in my rent, and my cat is sick.
It's 4 p.m, you're drunk.
I'm hardly drunk.
Craig, sober up.
Quite by accident, I find myself in a rather criminal position.
What criminal activity could possibly involve it, except a crime of fashion, of course?
I'm embellishing literary letters by prominent writers.
I love his writing.
Particularly clever, don't you think? Caustic wit.
This is quite something.
Let's talk about The Favourite first. It is such a fantastically weird movie, a psychedelic historic piece. 18th century high political lesbian love triangle. There's so many of them about these days. We're knee-deep in them. Linda, what's your take on The Favourite?
I love The Favourite. I love Yorgos. I'm a big Yorgos Lanthimos fan, and I've loved all his films. But I think this is the most sort of the most conventional one so far, because all of his films are usually really deadpan, and some people just don't relate to them. This has some proper acting and the proper comedy, and I love it. Is it going to win? It could, but I personally think it would probably be between it and Roma. The new Cuaron movie.
Why do we think Olivia Colman is sticking out in this? Because obviously she's the key. She's almost the kind of tentpole around the whole thing.
I think that's not fair, to be honest with you. I think all three did equally as much.
Yeah.
I think when it comes to award season, I think it's the production, it's the people who are selling the movie who decide who to put forward for Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress. I think that's what happens unofficially, and that's why she's getting all the sort of...
Who's seen The Favourite?
I have. I think Olivia Colman, we have this weird national obsession with her in this national treasure sort of way. And you're right, it's a three-parter. It's the other women in it as well. It is incredible, and it's all shot without lighting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all shot for real. So some of it's very dark, and it's on film as well. Lots of qualities about it, the fisheye lens and things that you just don't see in a lot of other, especially Hollywood movies. And I can't pronounce his second name, but I love Yorgos. Dogtooth is amazing. Lobster's amazing. Go and see the previous films if you haven't seen them, and then that kind of informs The Favourite.
It will tell you what...
little bit more about him as an auteur.
Yeah.
Wonderful film. My mum, I saw it with her, and she said, I would have walked out in the middle if you hadn't sat there, because she didn't like it.
Really?
Not for mums, maybe.
I'm still trying
She's
to work.
Quite broad-minded.
I'm still trying to come to terms with the ending, which is the ending's psychedelic meltdowns.
Psychedelic.
It's psychedelic. Yeah,
I think so many people have said this. I think the ending makes complete sense to me.
It does make complete sense, but it's at such odds with a historical drama.
It's bitter, isn't it?
I mean, I think that's he's basically saying, okay, I've given you a historical drama, I've given you sort of a costume drama, but let me have my own thing as well right at the end. So,
well, it's the kind of psychological truth behind the whole thing. I'll never look at a rabbit in the eye ever again as far as long as I live. Bohemian Rhapsody. Now, you hated this, didn't you, Linda?
I'm going to be really honest here. I don't think that... I don't recognise Freddie Mercury at all in this story because I just feel like it's been sanitised for sort of a mainstream audience. And Freddie Mercury wasn't the person who is represented in this film. I think lots of his sort of the gay side of him was basically not really approached the way, because he was really promiscuous, let's put it this way, you know. And I think... It's fine as a mainstream movie, as a movie for the masses, but I don't think it's the story of Freddie Mercury,
but
in my opinion.
But don't you think, though, to take the kind of devil's advocate thing on this, the fact that the film sort of decorously averts its eye as Freddie's about to go into the back room with a big bunch of belly lads is not, in any way a comment on that. It's simply saying that we now look at all sexualities as acceptable, normal, not to be judged. Therefore, why would you want to be prurient about that any more than you'd wish to be prurient about heterosexual sex?
It was a big part of who he was.
It was a big part of who he was.
I think making a film about Freddie Mercury and not approaching that side of it
Well, it did approach it. It just approached it in an elusive way rather than let's go in the back room, as I just said. I enjoyed... I thought he's a good performance surrounded by terrible cardboard cutouts and the kind of rock stories cliche of we need a hit, shall we call it Bohemian Rhapsody, I've got a rhythm and a tune here, it felt like a kind of it's visually incredible. I mean, the recreation of Live Aid at a technical level is astonishing. It's astonishingly shot, astonishingly put together, and I felt it's all in the service of a dreadfully, dreadfully thin treatment of a life and the Queen story. But then, Queen are the most obvious rock band ever, and this is the most obvious rock film ever. Yeah. It's not surprising, is it? And they were involved in the making. They basically produced it.
Oh, but it's really popular. I mean, I understand why it's popular. I think it's popular because people really love the songs. And I mean, you have teenagers go in like 3 or 4 times to see it. So
I'm the guy who said Mamma Mia was definitely going to be a flop, and We Will Rock You. So what do I know? Has anybody else seen Bohemian Rhapsody?
No, I don't.
You should see the face on Doran right now. I saw this at the Dolby Theatre, which revealed some hitherto unknown detail. I mean, it is an incredibly well constructed film, both visually and sonically, and to kind of have, you sort of think, why don't rock films treat the sound the way you would expect it to be treated?
Yeah.
That is definitely a plus to it, isn't it?
I think all films should be seen in Dolby, if possible. If possible. And I do get the odd sort of occasion of watching them at a press screenings at Dolby, and they just seem a lot more sort of immersive to me.
Yeah.
Then, and
there is enough capacity now, isn't there, for sort of home surround sound to...
Yeah.
You do sort of think... to an extent, you feel an element of sympathy for directors who are putting together these multidimensional things, and then they end up getting watched on a little streaming service.
Which is unfortunate. I mean, I was talking earlier about Roma, and Roma, I saw Roma at Dolby, and I think it's just the most amazing experience. You do almost get the feeling that there's people sitting behind you talking, and they're just in the film. So I think sound, people don't realise that sound is just as important as vision.
Yeah.
So,
Can You Ever Forgive Me? An amazing character.
Fantastic
piece.
Film, yes. I absolutely loved her story. This is about, what was it? Lee Israel, who used to write biographies about famous actors and actresses. And then when everything was dying down around her and she couldn't get a book deal, she started falsifying bonmots, like, you know, like her sort of quotes, and selling them off as real quotes and making money. And then she got arrested by the FBI in the end. It's a true story, and it's brilliantly acted by Melissa McCarthy. And what I loved about it is Richard E. Grant in it is just awesome. And I just would love him to win an Oscar for it.
There's massive pathos in both those characters, isn't it? And I, you know, the bits were, and this is not much of a spoiler, but Melissa McCarthy essentially saying, I thought I was going to be more than this, I was supposed to be more than this. Mm. And she's reached a pitch in her life where it's kind of all the good stuff has happened.
Yeah.
What's going to happen next? None of us was getting any
50s,
younger. I was a bit close to my,
Yeah.
But I just thought it was incredibly effective. But then Richard E. Grant is the flip side of that. He's reached a stage in his life where nothing more is going to happen.
He doesn't care.
No longer cares. Utterly irresponsible. And it's two brilliant bad influences.
I adore him. I just love, I think he's found himself in this movie. Mm.
It's a buddy movie, isn't it?
And yes.
The reason why I went to see it was because as much as you'd be interested in Lee Israel falsifying letters, you want to see the relationship between her and this gay alcoholic, as it was. And that's what glues it together. That's what the whole film is about their push me, pull you. They're not very nice to each other at
points. And they're awful people. They're really they're awful people.
Jack's parting line to Lee is one of the best lines ever in cinema. Won't spoil it, but it's just brilliant.
Yeah, and it is just glorious in that sense. I loved it.
I loved her. I loved her character because I really saw myself in her, because I can be a bit sort of, you know, like, you know, you know, can't be bothered with your nonsense. Mm. But I loved her. I think her character, it's really well written as well. And I think
she also prank calls her agent. She prank calls everybody.
I don't think it will win.
Richard E. Grant, do you think he'll get supporting
actor? Let's see. I mean, I'm hoping he will. I think Mahershala Ali, who's has been nominated for Green Book, could win it, but Green Book is a terrible movie, really. so it really doesn't deserve to win anything. So I'm hoping that Richard E. Grant might be sort of...
In my head canon, this is a long after sequel to With Nell and I and Jack and
Definitely, yes.
Can we do a shout out for Roma, though? Because loved
absolutely.
Roma.
Yeah. Roma is my favourite film of the year.
Right.
I will sort of die fighting for its honour. I think there's a mini backlash over it because people say it's a little bit pretentious. I don't think it's pretentious. I don't think there's such a thing as a pretentious movie. It's a love letter. It's a love letter to from Cuarón to his sort of city where he lived, where he was brought up. It's not just a love letter to Mexico. It's a love letter to this woman, this indigenous woman who brought him up. Mm. Her name was Libo, I think. And I just think... It broke me. It's a film that broke me. I think it needs to be seen on big screen.
Yes,
I know it's on Netflix. If you have a big screen at home, just have it on the big screen at home. Don't watch it on the small screen.
Or go very close.
Yeah.
So it's big.
I just absolutely loved it. From it's so cleverly done.
It reminded me of Ozu and Mitsuguchi, to be pretentious with Japanese filmmaking and giving it that pace and that time,
the slowness,
and that space.
And,
John Duran, have you seen it?
No, I've not.
You must.
And at this point, I would like to make my protest.
Go on,
I was
then.
Going to, at one point, send a Native American squaw down here today in my place. I love The Sound of Roma. I'm going to go and watch it next week. I also love Olivia Colman, but that's beside the point. The reason I'm angry today is the lack of nominations for Hereditary, which is, in some levels, one of the best films I've seen over the last 10 years. Again, because it ticks all of those boxes about determinism, existential crisis. It's a very, very smart film, but because it's a genre film, it's been absolutely blanked by the Oscars. And there's, like, you know, I will hold my hands up and say it's not a perfect film. There are a couple of scenes in that film which are absolutely whack. I think there's a bit where, just before Toni Collette, sorry about the spoilers, accidentally sets Gabriel Byrne on fire, there's
bit of a spoiler.
It's
been out for a year.
Don't worry. It's fine.
Darth Vader's his dad. Yeah, keep going.
Black Panther is in the best picture category. I mean, that's
come on, let's deal with this bit. Come on.
So there are a couple of bits where the acting is bad, the script is a bit shonky, but overall, Hereditary is an absolutely mind-blowing film. Like, Toni Collette's performance is absolutely astonishingly good.
Yeah.
Why wasn't it at least nominated?
Yeah.
You know, and Black Panther, yeah, sure, it's a genre film, but it's also a very, very popular genre film. It's very, very popular in the press and amongst audiences, and it's not that good.
Yeah, I think with Hereditary, what happened was that we all loved it to start with. Now, I mean, I loved it, and I gave it a really good review when it came out. And then some of the more sort of serious horror fans started to pick at it. You know, loads of like really sort of respected horror fans who are. Don't like Hereditary. They don't like it. It's not.
I know,
you know,
but they were approaching it on a very, very shallow level,
oh,
which
I
is
agree
like
with you.
Like
no,
saying,
I agree.
Well, you know, at this point when this scary thing happened, it was a bit like that film from that happened in the '70s. Like intellectually, what this film is doing, which is really to do with the relationship between mothers and daughters, it's got nothing to do with The Exorcist.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with Rosemary's Baby. And like I thought, like Mark Kermode's like review of this film,
I was waiting
film
for him to come up. Yes,
was particularly narrow-shouldered. Well, I thought it was okay, but some of my best friends who are into horror movies don't like this sort of thing. No one's paying you, Mark Kermode, like for you to repeat what your friends think of it. They're paying you to say what you think of it, you know. And like,
I think Mark was just being honest. If he didn't like it, he just said he didn't like it. Mark is my friend, so I have to defend him here.
Okay,
just because,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Just because I think he's a really honest critic, and I think what he didn't like about it, he said what he didn't like about it. I don't think it was just because some of his friends didn't like it. I think he is like a really hardcore horror fan, and has been for many, many years, since the days of Fangoria. So I totally see his point, but I agree with you, John. I really love the film.
Fair enough. All right, just to wrap it up, I just wish that some of these horror fans had have addressed the fact that it was called Hereditary. None of them talked about the core idea in the film, which it's about determinism. It's about what you inherit from your parents. You know, like it was all to do with, oh, this scary bit here, that scary bit there. Mm. That's not really what the film's about.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the ending was a bit not as strong as the rest of the movie. But I mostly agree with you, John, because I when I first saw it, I really, really
apologies
loved it.
Apologies.
<No, no. laughs> cracking on, just to wrap up quickly, you were pretty keen on If Beale Street Could Talk as well.
Oh, I
you?
Loved it. And I just don't understand why it's not in the Best Picture category. It's ridiculous. I think take out Vice or Green Book and put If Beale Street. It's the third movie from the director of Moonlight and Barry Jenkins, and it's an adaptation of a James Baldwin book from the 1970s, and it's just absolutely beautiful. It's a lyrical film, and the score is just to die for. And I think it will win Best Score.
Okay.
At least.
What are you putting your tenor on there for Best Picture and Best Actor / Actress?
I mean, it's an open one for Best Picture. Honestly, I know who I want to win. I think I want either Roma or The Favourite to win. Mm-hmm. And I think Roma will win. But, you know, Black Klansman could also win.
Well, Black Klansman's brilliant. Yeah. Yeah. We haven't talked about Black Klansman.
That could also win, yeah. You know. So it's an open one for Best Picture.
Actor and actress, what do you reckon?
Best actor, I think either Christian Bale or Rami Malek. I think Rami Malek would probably win it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't think he was that great personally, but you liked him more than I did.
Don't you think? Yeah. Do you think Sacha Baron Cohen would have done a better job?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. No.
I don't think Sacha Baron Cohen could have done The Athletics that Rami Malek does. But how much is he doing anyway? Yeah. It all seems to be so incredibly, you know, put together in with incredible post-production powers. Anyway, we're going to find out in due course. We've just got time, just about, for me to squeeze a track in. This is the new single from Lizzo, the Minneapolis hip-hop lady who has been on the build for a few years now. Her stuff is funny and clever. She's not your archetypal pop person. She's a formidable woman and, in her own words, a big girl with several R's. She's on house and disco and hip-hop, and now she goes full-on soul mental. She's got proper pipes on her. We are long overdue a one-woman outcast or a new Missy Elliott, and I really hope Lizzo is it. This is the title track from her upcoming album, Cause I Love You.
Got you something from the liquor store. Little bit of Lizzo and some mo. Trying to open up a little mo. Sorry if my heart a little slow. I thought that I didn't care. I thought I was loving bad. But baby,
standing in the rain. Gotta get my hair pressed again. I would do it for you all, my friend. Ready,
the end of the show is approaching, which means closing time chatter. What are our guests going to be discussing over a whiskey and soda while forging unreleased Sean Ryder lyrics? Linda, what's your closing time chatter?
Comedy train drivers.
Okay.
You know when you get on a train and you're trying to do some work, as I have become, I've become one of those people who does work on a train because I've just moved out of London, as I said, and you get a constant sort of stream of nonsense from someone who thinks they're a lot funnier than they are. And I just think, if you want to be a comedian, just go be a comedian. Please leave me out of it. I mean, I think some people find it really funny and entertaining. But once you've heard it a few times, if you've been on that line a few times, and you've had the same person doing the same shtick three or four times.
He might be a future rock star. Apparently, that's what Jar Wobble used to do when he was driving the tubes after he got kicked out of the Sex Pistols.
He did. Okay. He used to say,
well, good for him.
He used to come on the tube and say, this Victoria Line train will be calling at... Victoria and Stockwell, and then it will form part of the Orient Express and keep on going.
No, I have no problem. Look, it's fine. I'm sure other people absolutely love it, and I'm sure this makes me sound like a right misery guts. But I've had my share of comedy, of bad comedy, when I used to go to Edinburgh Festival. I think enough is enough.
Fantastic. Yeah, you know. John, what's your closing time chatter?
I had a pleasant morning yesterday at Shad Thames, Butler's Wharf, when I went to the unveiling of Derek Jarman's blue plaque. And I guess, it was really, really beautiful. The lovely Simon Fisher-Turner, the kind of like audio artist, and Peter Tatchell, amongst other people, were giving speeches. And there were a lot of, like, you know, artists there watching. And I was probably one of the youngest people there, or amongst the younger people there anyway. And I guess what it was making me think was, like, isn't this a shame that, you know, it's really good that Derek Jarman and all of his friends from 1974 and 1979 could take over these top four floors of a warehouse building right on the Thames and create their art. But where are the spaces that we're creating for artists today? Mm-hmm. I was up in Leeds a few days ago interviewing the band Fat White Family, who are part of the mass exodus of musicians and artists out of London. Now, they had played a headline gig at Brixton Academy while all of them were still homeless, and they've had to move to Sheffield. And it's like, at what level do you have to attain before you can be an artist and live in London and not have the privilege of parental wealth behind you?
Yeah, the blue plaques of the future are going to be in...
Surbiton.
Yeah, or, you know, Leeds and Sheffield and, you know...
Or there'd be Lord So-and-so who created his marvellous work.
I know.
Yeah. I'm so posh.
And Mumford, yes. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I'm going to become a Netflix documentary maker because there's a new Fire Festival... The world.
Fantastic.
There's another, the world's most exclusive festival, because I read the Tatler. Perhaps you have found it on the Tatler website. It's if you spend a weekend at Ondalinda, Mexico's best kept secret, and you spend, I think, it's another $100,000 business. There's a picture of some really posh people by some lights and some pretend grass. There's still a market in We Have a Festival. It's going to cost you lots of money. We'll give you a sip of champagne. Can you give us everything you've ever owned? Yeah, so I think that's the new Netflix documentary. That's going to do it. Do you not find, though, that sometimes when you're reading these articles, and they're so terribly highfalutin, you turn into the Sunday format? If anyone remembers the Sunday format on Radio 4, where they come for the first-class DJs and late night, and it just dissolves into something then about, you know...
Like rich people, blue jam for rich people.
Jam for rich people, it just descends into a very nice, quiet hum of words which you're reading but you're really not interested in.
It's the ASM, whatever it is.
I can't read the London Review of Books in the bath for fear of drowning.
There we go. So this goes on and on and on, this
feature.
But
don't you think, though?
That's bloody festival.
Firstly, somebody, possibly even on this podcast, I can't remember, somebody did say, we're all laughing at Fire Festival, but somebody's going to look at that and go, I could do that for real.
Yeah, which they're doing.
And it's happening.
Although Burning Man has cast out poshos. That's the flip side to it.
Oh.
Yeah, the Humano, the Tribe, are being cast out this year because they're all the models that just do that
Wearing a straw hat.
Yeah.
But secondarily, while we talk about horror films,
Where is the horror film where a fire festival is just a magnet to launch a load of rich people and to lure a load of rich people and murder them on an island somewhere?
I really hope someone's
can we
making
get funding
it
for that. Linda, you've got contacts. Let's make this
yeah,
happen.
Yeah. Let's do it. Let's
I can
do
have a deck
it.
Together by tea time and we can we can get this
film. I think
throw
in loads of influencers in there for real and then make them go through hell.
Absolutely. Yeah, it would be called the executive glamping tents have eyes or something like that. Anyway, my closing time chat is also about festivals. It's about the fake Fortnite festival, the unofficial Fortnite festival, which was a total disaster last week, and it confirmed that even modern video games are not immune from rubbish winter wonderland syndrome. You know those stories when it's like there's a winter wonderland in Warrington and actually it turns out to be one dog wearing plastic and a single sad Christmas tree wilting
and all the children cried
and all the parents. The parents pay between £14 and £22. I had to shell out £20 extra for activities like a cave experience that turned out to be a tunnel running through a trailer with a slide. Justin Peterson, who queued for 90 minutes, said it was like the episode of Father Ted when the fair comes to Craggy Island.
My gosh.
But I think this is good because kids who've got Fortnite and video games everywhere...
You don't want to go to the festival of it.
No, this is why it's good, because they have never encountered disappointment before. They've never encountered real-world failure, the drabness of reality.
I'm down with that.
They had a climbing wall that could only take three kids.
You're a cruel man, Andrew Harrison.
They had a climbing wall that could only take three kids at a time, and 2,000 kids had turned up there to queue for 3 hours to go on a climbing wall. This, I think, will be an excellent formative experience. You've got to get ripped off at some time in your life. You've got to feel miserable, bored and cheated at some time in your life.
Says mean uncle.
It made us what we are today, Sean. Look at us.
Yeah.
And I think this is good. So more of this. I think it is, as my dad used to say, it'll make a man of you. It didn't, but it made something of me. And that, I believe, is the end of the show. Thank you very much Linda Marek and John Doran for coming in. John, what's coming up in the quietus next?
Oh, more railing against fascism and extreme music, which means for me more conversations with narrow-shouldered idiots every single time I leave the house.
Excellent.
Some features on things like Underworld, Fat White Family and Little Sims.
Lovely. Linda, what films are you going to see next? What are you excited about next?
Captain Marvel that we're both going to see soon, which I'm really looking forward to. I mean, there's a few things.
There's quite a lot of places.
I think Under the Silver Lake is coming out sometime in March, which I absolutely loved, but everyone hated that can.
Okay.
And go see it when it comes out. It's a really lovely movie.
Okay, well, John and Linda are going to stick around for the extra bit where we will discover the best and worst people that they've interviewed. Thanks to co-pilot Sean Patton and producer Alex Rees. We'll see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.